Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Russians and the Americans are talking again. The media is abuzz about ending sanctions. The Europeans, as usual, are angry, confused, and divided. In short, there are high expectations about dramatic change. So, where is the Trump peace plan? Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Steve Jeremy in Cornwall. He is a retired Royal Navy Commodore. In Rome, we have Thomas Fadzi. He is an author as well as a columnist for the British Unheard and the American Compact magazines. And in Lake Jackson, we cross to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, because you got up earliest for the program, we very much value your presence here at this early hour. And speaking of hours, you know, I have a different time zone than you guys. So every time I wake up in the morning, it looks like there's a different peace plan. There's no peace plan. There's minerals. There's bilateral relations. Nothing much about Ukraine yet. Daniel.
Well, I think it's a big problem. The deputy foreign minister of Russia has been saying this week, Ryabkov, that we haven't seen a peace plan. We don't know what the peace plan is. I mean, on the one hand, we're rather sanguine about the seemingly positive turn in relations between the U.S. and Russia. We've talked many times, Peter, when we were on the verge of nuclear war, and it doesn't seem we are that way right now. So there's something to be grateful for. However, I think there are inchoate signals coming from Washington, particularly coming from Trump himself. So exactly as you say, what is the peace plan? We know that later in the week, the working group will be meeting in Istanbul, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But this week has been a somewhat confusing one, I have to admit, when it comes to U.S.-Russia relations.
You know, Steve, it's very interesting. We had it during the Sunday programs in the United States. We had Steve Witkoff, which appears to be Trump's at-large envoy. He said to the American people, it's not a surprise to anyone on this program or anyone watching this program, but he pushed back against the thesis that the conflict in Ukraine was unprovoked. And he said, you know, and then we had Pete Hegseth saying, well, it's more complicated than that. That is a sea change. I mean, that is incredible, because what I have argued on this program for 3 years is that all the West has is framing and narratives. It's divorced from reality. Reality is seeping in here, but I don't see where it's going beyond bettering bilateral relations. And as Daniel has said, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. But it's not enough. Go ahead, Steve.
I was welcomed Hegseth's comments. I mean, what we've got is two critical observations, I think, from the Americans. The first is from Rubio, is that actually they no longer see them as an hegemonic world. We're in a multipolar world. And essentially in that multipolar world, there are three great powers, the three obvious ones. And two of them are at last talking. So it's a welcome thing that they're talking. I think in terms of the unprovokedness, well, I think there's two sets of thinkers in the West. There are those who I call the true believers, who are expansionists, who believe that the war was nothing to do with NATO expansion, and that actually it started in 2022, or a little bit earlier back in the Maidan Revolution. And there are the realists, of which I'm one. We're voices in the wilderness until recently, but we're the people who've been saying, this started back in 1996, for example, when George Kennan said that it was the biggest foreign mistake in post-war history for the Americans to expand and the Europeans to expand, and going on all the way through, going through to Putin's desire to join NATO and be rebuffed through the Bill Burns's "Niet means Niet" telegram, and most recently John Mishma. So, of course, this was as it is. What's the problem, though, Peter, is that the West is being guided by a political narrative, whereas Russia's being guided by a military strategy. And unfortunately, a lot of the people have bought into the political narrative, even though, as far as I can see, it rests on nothing.
Well, yeah, and it's going to... It's a problem, and it's a problem that's only going to get worse here. I mean, I have a plan. I'm going to send out a plan. I'm in negotiations. You can just do that so long. Let me go to Thomas in Rome. You know, as I've said, you know, the bettering of relations between Russia and the United States is a really good a change. But it's not solving the Ukraine problem, the Ukraine dilemma for both the United States and Russia here. And one of the criticisms I would have of the approach here is it's too many voices, there are too many people talking in the U.S., on the U.S. side here. It's very confusing. And Donald Trump is his own worst enemy when it comes to this because he says conflicting things. Thomas.
Yeah, I think like everyone else, I'm feeling positively bipolar these days, swinging between wild optimism and pessimism. So, as the other guests have said, of course, having an American president and various American officials acknowledge that the origins of this war and that this war was provoked by NATO, and I would add even deliberately provoked, and it's of course a huge deal and a big step forward towards achieving peace, because only once you acknowledge that the other side is not motivated by irrational, crazy impulses, but actually has actual concerns that need to be addressed, do you create an environment where you can sit down around a table and try to address the concerns of all sides. So this is definitely a big deal. But I think what a lot of people are underestimating is that this is only the first step towards achieving peace. I mean, the road to peace remains very long and tortuous. And I think people are underestimating just how difficult this will be, because reaching peace in Ukraine is about much more than just acknowledging Russian control over the annexed territories, something that Trump even seems willing to concede. And it's not even just about stopping NATO expansion. But from Russia's perspective, it's about much more than this. It's about deeply reforming the international system in such a way that great power proxy wars and proxy conflicts like the one we're seeing in Ukraine and elsewhere don't repeat in the future. So this is about really redefining the global balance of power, and for the U.S. and the West more in general to accept the multipolar nature of today's global reality, and even allow for the peaceful rise of new centers of power, China, of course, but also Russia. And in this sense, yes, we've heard positive statements also kind of acknowledging the multipolar reality of today's world from key Trump administration officials. But I still think that Trump remains, and this is my greatest worry, beholden to a certain sort of supremacist and hegemonic view of American power, and even more importantly, a zero-sum view of international relations, where the relative decrease of American power due to the rise of other powers continues to be seen in terms of kind of a threat to America's kind of vital security interests, rather than just the first step towards America just becoming a normal country. And I find this, I think this is probably the biggest obstacle towards reaching a long-term settlement with Russia.
I couldn't have said it better, that you're absolutely right, because this is all about a big picture here. Daniel, let's go smaller picture for a second before we go to the break. Is there, again, in the West and even among the Trump team, a ceasefire is equated with peace. They're two very different things. They're actually not the same at all. Daniel.
Well, exactly. The problem is the order. The Americans are seemingly, because it changes every day, Peter, seemingly they're emphasizing the need for a ceasefire first. Russia has said through its foreign minister Lavrov and others that this is a non-starter. We're not going to do Minsk again. We've been there. We've done that. We're not going to do it again. The U.S. is insisting on this, maybe as something that they can show to the press, see, we've gotten something done. I mean, I think for Russia, this is, as they've said clearly, this is an existential war. This is something that's part of our national survival strategy. For the U.S., it almost seems at times like we need to put one up on the win board for us. So let's get this thing done. Come on, guys, do peace. If you don't, there's going to be a problem. And I think that's a real issue. And I think that President Trump has had a fairly bad week this last week in the signing ceremony, where he claimed he took credit for giving the javelin. He said the war would never have started if I was president. Oh, and by the way, I got the war started because I gave javelins. It was a schizophrenic, terrible, terrible nightmare performance. And it wasn't his only this week. So it's actually quite disturbing to hear him say this.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know. I throw a lot of shade on this minerals deal. I think it's a sideshow. I think it's maybe a diversion about not talking about NATO. But I mean, at the end of the day, this whole minerals and investment thing doesn't make any sense if there isn't any peace in Ukraine. Go ahead, Steve.
I think that's probably right, although I work in the offshore energy sector now after my first naval trip. And I think there is a lot to be said for countries cooperating commercially. So the fact that actually the Americans and the Russians are talking about commercial discussions, in my view, is a good thing. I'm not saying that it's going to bring a peace to Ukraine, of course.
Yeah, but Steve, it's not the center of things. I absolutely agree with what you're talking about, but it's not stopping the conflict. That's my issue here. Keep going.
Yeah, no, I think in terms of stopping the conflict, as has been said, this is going to take time. You know, if you've been to war and you know that at the end of it, it's not much fun and it's going to be very, very difficult. I do think we need to understand, though, that the longer it takes, then the less that Ukraine and Europe will have to negotiate with, because Russia is acting in its own national security interests, which is what I would do in their situation. And they will keep going until they feel that they've actually got a secure, what I would call as a secure border. I thought back in 2022 that the way that it would probably all finish would be that Russia would, if it could not find anybody to negotiate, would get up to the Dnieper River, because that would provide a very natural strategic defense line. And then I had a question mark, which I still have, about Odessa. But yeah, this is going to take time. But the first and very most important thing is that the Americans and the Russians are talking. I can't emphasize how important this is. So it may feel a bit chaotic at the moment, but it's much better that we're talking. Diplomacy has begun rather than not. So I think we just have to be patient, difficult though it is, when you see all the unnecessary killing going on.
Yeah, and all of the chaos that's happening in the Western world, particularly NATO and what's going on with European elections. I mean, there's a whole lot in the mix here, and no one is on the same page at this point. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine, Trump, and the peace plan. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump and the peace plan in Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Thomas in Rome. I just have this deep-seated feeling watching the last couple of weeks since the famous phone call. Okay, let's start there. Thomas, is Trump trying to do a reverse Nixon goes to China? And is this about Yalta 2.0? Because Trump is so, he doesn't have a grasp of the details. His grasp of the ideas are getting better and better. But details, history, that's not his forte. He's a deal maker, as everyone knows. And the deal he wants is some kind, and it's already been mentioned here, some kind of global deal. Maybe he saw a short documentary on Yalta, and I know he's obsessed with China. He's been obsessed with China since the 1990s. Is this what this is all about, Thomas?
I think it is in partly what it's about. I think the idea that, you know, he might be trying to pull a Nixon strategy in reverse, I think has some value to it. And in fact, I think Kellogg himself has said as much. I mean, he said that, you know, he expects Russia to, move away from China, and that should be part of a deal. And, honestly, I see this strategy as one that is likely to fail, first and foremost, because Kellogg, as well as other, Trump envoys, neither of them is Nixon. But also because I think, they fail to realize the importance and sort of the historic relevance of Russia's eastward shift. I mean, this wasn't just something that Russia decided on a whim. I mean, this came on the heels of, I would say almost 30 years after the end of the Cold War, of Russia trying to integrate into the Western sphere, into the transatlantic sphere, and just having the door shut in its face. And so that's basically what and that culminated in the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, which was Russia, Russia's way of telling the world, okay, I've realized that there's no way of peacefully reforming the system. There's no way you're going to allow us into this system, and so we're going to do it some other way. We're going to force the other major powers to to change their approach to international relations. And to some extent, Russia has succeeded. This is where we're at now. But of course, when you see Trump, you know, wanting to use this as a moment to kind of, you know, redefine or have a geopolitical grand bargain in the U.S. interests rather than in Russia's interests, you realize that, yes, he does seem to be kind of, you know, misreading the room, because, you know, if it's pretty clear to everyone that the U.S. and NATO have lost on the battlefield, but that means that then you can't really, impose the conditions for peace. And I think, yes, in this respect, it's hard to be optimistic, really, because I think, you know, this is about accepting that, you know, we have thrown Russia into China's arms and vice versa, something that, you know, would for a long time was, you know, something that, you know, avoiding this was one of America's overarching priorities, right? But this is something that can't be reversed overnight. And I think accepting, not only does the West and the U.S. Have to accept the multipolar nature of today's world, but it also has to accept the fact that the West is sidelined in this new in this new world, because the other two major blocs are in very good friendly terms, largely thanks to us. And I think the way of addressing that is not through blackmailing. It's not through trying to strong arm Russia or anyone else. But it's this will be a long process where the West finally starts to humbly admit its mistakes reimagines its role in the world.
Reimagine its place in the world. So well put, Daniel. Is that possible? You've been on this program since the very beginning here, and we have talked about hegemony and the empire. Can it learn different? Can the old empire learn some new tricks? I mean, at the end of the day, that's what this is all about, Daniel.
I mean, from the perspective of American exceptionalism, what's happening now is either colossally brilliant or colossally stupid. And it goes to the Nixon-China thing. There are plenty of realists, and no offense to realists out there, I'm not one of them, who believe that getting a deal with Russia is very important because the United States military machine has to pivot towards China and, to a lesser degree, Latin America. And so they want the same game in a different area, and they believe that Russia is a country they can deal with, get out of the way, put that off the list, and do the real focus over here. I think that will be a disaster for the U.S., and it will not work because, as you've said, this is a different world than Trump stepped into in 2017. The world has changed partly because of U.S. foreign policy, which to a degree has pushed countries together that have not been as close as before, Russia with Iran and Saudi Arabia particularly. On the other hand, maybe it's colossally brilliant. Maybe the American exceptionalists are getting Putin to once again kick that football that Lucy has teed up and fall on his rear end, which may actually be the demise of Putin, which is the end-all goal of the neocons in the U.S. and the American exceptionalists in the U.S. to finally take down Putin. Because I do believe that if he takes the bait from the West again, as he's done several times, and it goes down as it will, then it may be the end of Putin.
Well, I mean, and Steve, obviously, Russia wants to have good relations with all countries. I mean, that's perfectly natural. But the going back to what Daniel had to say there, and it's already been mentioned on this program, there's not going to be another Minsk process. We've already been there. We've seen that. And Putin was heavily criticized for it within Russia itself. They're not going to do that. I mean, what Trump is asking is, you know, Russia to take yourself off the board for a while. Well, the Russians are not going to do that. Everyone knows that. Steve.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. I mean, I think the issue is that whether you believe that the West has failed or been defeated or about to be defeated, it appears clear to most people with any military brains that is the case. So we're not in a position where even America can dictate terms on Russia. And I think the other problem, so A, we can't dictate terms. I think the other problem is trust. And this is something that Putin wrote about, I think, during the Obama time in a sort of positive way. And what you see if you look back through history, and most neocons and neolibs don't understand history as far as I can see, or they think it starts in 2022.
Yeah.
What you see is the Americans and Westerners withdrawing unilaterally from carefully crafted and intelligently constructed arms control treaties, nuclear arms control treaties. And then, of course, there are the Minsk agreements and the problems associated with that. And, of course, there's Istanbul and you know, the Americans and the British persuading Zelensky not to sign. So I think that the Russians have a reason to be cautious. I think we've got to accept that there is a that we will need to be able to build up trust over time, and that won't come through a confrontational approach to future relations. We've got to move from NATO's confrontational security to an architecture in Europe. This is much more about cooperative security.
Right, right. And well, and Thomas, the current security arrangement in Europe was done without the Russians and against the Russians, which brings up another point. We're talking about big global changes, and it's wide open what could happen. But I have a deep-seated feeling that the transatlantic tradition is coming to an end, which would be a good thing in my mind. Thomas.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm just not so sure it's actually happening. I mean, you know, we've mostly spoken about the U.S. today, but I think, you know, a huge obstacle to peace today is Europe and European countries, which seem to have got swept up in their own propaganda in a way. Quite amazingly, you know, they seem to have, you know, told their people and told their citizens for 3 years that this war is about democracy and sovereignty and et cetera, et cetera. You know, they've repeated that, you know, so often that, you know, it's as if they've now started believing that themselves, which would explain the shock at Trump, you know, turning the table, you know, as if they're like, wait a minute, what's happening? You know, as if they truly believe the propaganda that was coming from Washington and even from their own selves, you know. So I think, you know, we maybe, you know, need to kind of, you know, resort to psychology to some extent to explain what's happening here, because a lot of it, I think, is fairly irrational. But I think, you know, we shouldn't underestimate. Of course, people are right when they say that Europe can't, you know, without the U.S. Continue to allow Ukraine to continue fighting for that long, and it certainly won't be able to allow Ukraine to achieve any form of success on the battlefield. But it can seriously hinder any, you know, the peace talks. It can, you know, and this warmongering and fear-mongering rhetoric that we keep hearing from European leaders. It's, again, you know, we've mentioned trust. I mean, I think, yes, whatever little trust Russia may have vis-a-vis the U.S., I think that, you know, they trust Europe even less. Europe today is you know, how could anyone trust Europe's current leadership? I think that this is a huge, huge problem, and you know, they seem, you know, positively deranged in many respects. I mean, this is I think, you know, really a very, very serious issue. And when it comes to
hang on, let me give the last word to Daniel. I mean, staying with the Europeans here, I mean, I think they're more upset about being wrong than not being able to help Ukraine. 1 minute, go ahead, Daniel.
No, I think, I mean, I like what my colleague has said, but I actually believe that Europe is losing its grip. And that's why it's turning to force. That's why it's arrested Georgescu in Romania this past week.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely terrified of people like Viktor Orban and Robert Fico and many others that are emerging. I mean, things go a little bit more slowly in Europe than the U.S. when it comes to electropolitics. But look at the victory of the AfD in Germany. The people of Europe are literally holding up their middle finger to their leadership right now, and the leadership is in full panic mode. The one indelible picture in my mind is the Europeans sitting in Paris in the kids' table and Mark Rutte sitting right there with them saying, we're so mad that we're not invited to the big kids' table, i.e. Putin and Trump speaking. So I think Europe is losing its grip. It's going a little bit more slowly, but it's, I think, something that's inevitable.
Well, we have about 15 seconds more. Do you think the electoral process in Europe will continue the trend that we've seen from France, the U.K. and Germany? Go ahead, Daniel.
I think yes, but slowly. And I think J.D. Vance has done a great service to freedom and liberty when he lectured the Europeans with something I normally don't like, telling them we are not sharing values anymore. Look at what you're doing. You're suppressing the desires of your people, the expression of your people. I think that will go down in history as one of America's finest moments.
Well, we'll hope so. And I hope it somehow will end this conflict in Ukraine, because even on this program, we don't see the roadmap just yet here. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Cornwall, Rome, and in Lake Jackson. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.